Welcome to our Core Christi Monthly Discussions. My name is Rachel Pachta, and I am the Director of Ministry for the Missioners of Christ. For the next 3 months, we are studying the context of holiness, psychological and spiritual reflections on the life of St. Thérèse of Lisieux by Father Mark Foley. I'll be joined in these discussions by Father Dominic Foster, who's a TOR friar who teaches human and spiritual integration, among other things, at Franciscan University of Steubenville. We'll talk today about maybe some of the incorrect ideas that people can have about holiness and what grace and holiness really entails. And we'll also spend some time talking about St. Thérèse's early life and one of my very favorite saints, her mother, St. Zélie. So we hope that our discussion is helpful. I know that it was helpful for me to talk to Father Dominic during this time. And so without further ado, here is our first of three discussions on the context of holiness. Father Dominic, welcome to our Core Christi book study. We're excited to have you.
Good to be with you, Rachel.
And I know that I've talked to the small group leaders a lot about you and how we know each other. But before that, can you tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Father Dominic Foster. I'm a Franciscan TOR, a Catholic priest also as well. And I did about 10 years of ministry before I decided and was given permission to go back and get a degree in counseling. So in my previous life, I was director of evangelization here at Franciscan University. So I did a lot of ministries that focused on evangelization. But as time went on, I also had a large ministry of spiritual direction and saw that I was not able to help a lot of the people that were coming to me in the ways that they needed to be helped. And I thought it would be good for me to go and get a counseling degree. And so in 2018, I received an MS in clinical mental health counseling from Loyola, Maryland, was reassigned to Franciscan University, and have been practicing counseling and teaching in the psychology department here ever since.
That is awesome. Mm-hmm. So I remember when, so for everyone's context, for how I know Father Dominic was at Franciscan doing all of the things that he just described when I was a student studying theology at Franciscan University. So that's how we got to know each other and have had, like, you know, it started as director, spiritual director, and like working with you in ministry. And then after, you know, you were no longer my spiritual director, when I went off into post-college life, just kind of became friend, wouldn't mm-hmm. you say? Yeah.
I would say, yeah.
Yes. And so, yeah. And I remember when you were talking about the idea of becoming a counselor and being able to help people in that way. So I'm just curious, how has, like, you being a counselor and you being previously being a spiritual director, because do you direct people anymore?
I don't do a lot of spiritual direction now because I was full-time counseling for a long right. time and didn't have the time to do it.
Okay. So how are those things different? How are they similar and how are they different?
That's a very broad question, but I would say that spiritual direction basically is about helping somebody to, I mean, there's different definitions I could give. There was one that I was given in my graduate program, but I would say spiritual direction in a sense is about helping somebody become holy and presuming a Catholic understanding of grace and the human person. A definition I heard one time was helping somebody, the sort of more secular definition I heard in my program was helping somebody to attain the righteous life or the good life according to the God of their understanding. Okay. So that was okay. kind of more of a, and so if you're a Catholic, obviously the God of your understanding is based on the revelation that we believe as Catholics. So in other right. words, helping somebody to achieve the righteousness, achieve the good life according to what we believe is God's will for our lives. Okay.
Okay.
Counseling is kind of a different thing. Counseling is where you're looking at somebody's past history and their current beliefs, trying to figure out how that is influencing their behavior, either for good or for ill, and helping people to achieve human integration through the use of psychotherapeutic techniques. So that's probably all very graduate school and a little bit kind of up there, but
yeah,
they're very related, but they're not exactly the same thing either. So right. A spiritual director, for instance, so here are some of the things maybe that a counselor would pick up on that a spiritual director would not. If somebody, for instance, wants to pray hours and hours and hours and hours every day, a spiritual director is going to maybe say, oh, that's good. It makes you holy. It's a wonderful thing, potentially. But a counselor is going to say, are you practicing avoidance behavior? So a counselor is going to ask a question like, what's motivating the behavior? Why does somebody want to do this? Why does somebody want to pray for hours every day? Why is somebody attracted to a certain type of liturgy? Why is somebody blah, 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 blah. So that's, so a counselor is going to look at spiritual questions differently than a spiritual director will. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. That's an awesome.
So a lot of times as human beings, like we have, what a lot of people don't understand is that their spiritual preferences, their liturgical preferences, things like that, are sometimes being driven by things that are unconscious and that people don't necessarily even understand,
Okay.
And so, for instance, like in spiritual direction, a spiritual director sometimes is not attentive to the ways that maybe a directee is looking for a father figure and is creating cycles of dependency with the spiritual director.
Mm-hmm.
A spiritual director sometimes doesn't catch that stuff.
Right.
No. Whereas a counselor is going to look at that and say, why are you attracted to this person? Right. what need are you trying to be met? And a spiritual director and a directee probably are not doing a lot of reflection on the nature of that relationship.
Right.
See what I mean? Where a counselor is going to be more. So in other words, if a person has a tendency toward dependency,
right,
that's going to impact the way not only they relate to a spiritual director, but the way they relate potentially to a future spouse.
Right.
Or the way they relate to a future boss.
Right.
And so sometimes, a spiritual director may not necessarily have the tools to be able to question what's governing a person's behavior and may not be able to tell the difference between what's a healthy behavior and what's an unhealthy behavior. And is this person's spirituality really healthy or is it not healthy? Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes total sense. Like, this is really personal, but I have a feeling that's going to happen in this particular book anyway. But when I've gone through things really difficult, like having a miscarriage, miscarrying a child.
Yeah.
Okay. I had a really difficult time. And there were I don't know if this is the right way to say it, but spiritual elements of it and psychological elements of it.
Sure.
But the thing was, my whole person went through it.
Right. You couldn't conveniently separate it.
No, because it wasn't separated. My whole self was experiencing it and going through it and growing through it.
And I think the problems come in people's lives when they don't really know the difference between the two and when they confuse one with the other, or they radically separate one from the other.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting here, looking at this chapter on the wounds of childhood, and it talks about the death of Therese's mother, and it says how the death of Therese's mother was so traumatic that it determined how she experienced the different chapters of her life. It became her inner reference point. Therese experienced herself as she was before her mother died, how she was after her mother died, and how she was when she regained what she had lost at the time of her mother's death. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's fascinating with Therese. First of all, the whole psychology of her mother, which I think I had never read anything about, and how that impacted her. But you think about Therese and the fact that her mother died and then Pauline left her, who had become kind of the second mother figure. Mm-hmm. It also talks about the idea of anaclitic depression and the sense that, my mother has died. She was anxious. She couldn't comfort me in the way that I needed to because she had lost her own children and had a difficult childhood herself. And so, someone like Therese grows up and that sort of deep kind of inner depression, the feeling of abandonment, You know, and so when you have that experience of the death of your mother, not being comforted by her as a small child, then the attachment figure that you latch onto ends up leaving you. You know, this sense that these intimate relationships can be lost, mm-hmm. the sense of constant abandonment, of waiting for that abandonment to happen again. Mm-hmm. First of all, that's going to have a radical impact on your human personality and your ability to engage constructively in relationships. It's also going to have a huge impact on your understanding of God.
Yeah.
You know? And so sometimes a spiritual director can listen to somebody say, I just feel abandoned by God. I feel nothing. I feel like my faith is dead. And the poor spiritual director really doesn't know what to do with that. Maybe says something pious, like just accept it as your cross, or it's the dark night of the soul, which is completely unhelpful because he's not getting to the core of why that person is interpreting their experience the way that they are.
Right.
You know, right. And so a psychological background can really help somebody understand that. And right. So when you look at the history of Therese's relationships and also her scrupulosity, the way that she understood God, you know, it's impacted by that experience of early loss in a way that is not necessarily obvious, sometimes even to the person who's going through it. So a person who's looking at that, you know, that constant sense of darkness, depression, mm-hmm. fear of abandonment, they may not necessarily be saying, you know, this is my issue. They think that's just the way the world works.
Right.
And they think that's who God is. And until somebody comes along and helps them understand the origin of that experience, they're going to continue to interpret it through those same types of lenses.
Right.
And these are the types of things that spiritual directors are not necessarily trained to look at. And why spiritual directors sometimes can lead people astray unwittingly, you know, by telling the person, just accept it as your cross. It's the dark night of the soul. It's not the dark night of the soul. It's anaclitic depression, you know, and it's unlikely that the person is ever going to get any resolution just by being told to pray more or to just accept it as your cross or whatever. So, and I think the genius of this book is it shows us how Therese, with all of those issues, is able to find God in the context of who she is with those issues. And she doesn't, in a sense, have to abandon who she is to be somebody else to experience the grace of God. But as a girl who grew up with significant attachment trauma, could experience God nonetheless in those broken places and learn. And those broken places become the very places where she learns to invite God's grace in.
Right.
But she can't deny who she is. She can't deny her past trauma. She can't deny mm-hmm. her experience. What this book, I think, teaches people to do is to be completely honest with who they are.
Yeah.
And their childhood wounds and their traumas, whatever they may be, and to invite God into those places.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we sort of disavow those places and shove them down into the shadow, they go completely undealt with. They exercise enormous control over our personalities. And we have no idea why this stuff keeps happening over and over and over again. And I think Therese is brilliant because she is, as the book says so well, she doesn't apologize. In a sense, Therese is, people will say she's kind of crazy. Well, you know what? She is. She's a little crazy, you know, but she doesn't apologize for it. And she doesn't, in the end, it doesn't deny it. She says, this is who I am. And I'm loved by God in spite of all of my trauma and my crazy and my attachment disorders and all of that stuff. Although she wouldn't have had that language in the 19th century to be able to understand that. She understood that she had to be who she was before God and not somebody else.
Right.
You know, and I think for so many of us who are Christians, we have, you know, he talks a little later in the book about Jung's concept of the persona and how we identify with certain sets of values. And that becomes who we are, and all the undesirable parts of our personality mm-hmm. that don't fit with those values we've identified with, we sort of shove into our unconscious, but they don't go away.
Right.
And so a spiritual director is not necessarily going to understand those things, but a counselor really can help you understand those things and understand why who you are is being influenced by all of these things that you might not even be aware of.
Right.
I don't know what you think about this, but I wanted to talk about Zelly.
Okay. Let's talk about Zelly.
Okay. So I am
But Therese had some mommy issues.
She did have some mommy issues.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's crucial.
Yeah.
It's crucial to who she became and who she was.
Yeah. And I read through those pages, not only loving Therese, but also having read St. Zelie's letters and knowing a lot about her. Mm-hmm. I also read through that and I was almost relieved thinking, yes, like this woman who I feel in some times like I really knew her through reading her at certain points, that she can have these struggles and that her, you know, her anxiety could affect her family in such a way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And yet she became a saint and this amazing fruit came out of her. And the thing that she over and over in her letters, I mean, she moves from one tragedy to another.
Absolutely.
And
it's crucial for understanding.
Oh, I
Therese.
Mean,
yeah.
Oh, it's unbelievable almost when you read, when I was reading her letters, you know, and she's going through life. And I remember the point that he's talking about where she says, you know, I have nightmares about this. I have nightmares about losing this child.
Right.
I remember one time after she had lost her 5.5-year-old, her Len, where she was like, I'm walking around in a daze. Like I don't even, I can't even think. Mm-hmm. And it, like those are all classic things that we hear now when we're learning about, you know, depression and
trauma,
PTSD trauma, you know, like
these are all. As soon as you said that, it sounded to me like if I were a counselor, I would say, I wonder if she's experiencing some type of dissociation from the trauma that she experienced, you know, because she has experienced, Zelie lost several children.
Yeah.
Okay. So this isn't just, you know, losing a child is not a small event in a woman's life.
Right.
And she lost four of them.
Right.
So Zelie walks into her marriage. Zelie walks into her marriage with some baggage.
Yeah.
You know, and that's important to understand. And then she loses these four babies. And so Zelie becomes a very anxious mother. Mm-hmm. And you know, the book does a wonderful job talking about that, about how, you know, in a sense, like the infant is absorbing the mother's anxiety. And I say that not to make mothers feel more guilty, but, you know, just to kind of recognize that Zelie's experience of her family of origin and having lost those babies, you know, produced in her a very anxious temperament that Therese then begins to pick up on, you know? And so the human experience here is really unavoidable if you're trying to understand these two women and their experiences of loss, of depression, of anxiety, and the way it impacts that mother-daughter dyad is formative for who Therese becomes. And you can't pretend to understand Therese if you don't understand the role that her mother's anxiety played in Therese's life.
Right. A phrase that I picked up in counseling from a counselor, a functional thought, if you will, if that rings a bell, was, you know, I'm doing the best I can with my current awareness, my current set of resources. Like I'm doing the next right thing that I know.
That's right.
And I just thought that was Zelie because she didn't have the advantage. In the introduction to her letters, it's a psychologist wrote the introduction to it. And he was like, listen, she did not have the advantage.
Correct. Yeah.
Of like a robust, experienced counselor.
No.
Walking her through trauma after trauma after trauma. Mm-hmm. She lived in a time period in which the reason her children died was because infant mortality and childhood mortality was much higher in France at that time than it would be now. Yeah. So she also lived in an environment when it wasn't like she was dreaming up this anxiety. There was a good chance another child could die.
Could die, sure.
And they didn't know why the children were dying. That's the thing, too. They didn't have that, like, concept of how germs spread in the same way that we do now. So they didn't know, like, why does everybody keep getting tuberculosis? Like, could it be because we're giving it to each other? We have no idea. And so, you know, for her to be going through that, plus the trauma of her own childhood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just made me think, like, how good our Father is, that he knows our littleness and our weakness. Mm-hmm. And I see Zelie mm-hmm. and I think, man, isn't she the one who really lived the little way? Mm-hmm. You know, Therese goes on to talk about it and teach about it. I love the point where she's Melanie Therese, who's the baby that she lost right before Therese died, or before she had Therese, who was her last. She has this prayer to God, and she wrote it in a letter to her sister-in-law. And she said, I've asked God for one more child, because she couldn't conceive. She wasn't conceiving children for a little while after the loss of Melanie Therese. She said, I've asked God for one more child, and this child will be my special Therese. Mm-hmm. And I think, oh man, how he provided, mm-hmm. you know? And Leonie, they talk a lot about her stress with Leonie, who was a very, like, especially when you read Zelie's letter themselves, this was a multiple time a day struggle of a children who severely, and one thing that he doesn't talk about in this book, but I think is really good for understanding Leonie and also Zelie, was that Zelie found out herself 3 months before she died, that it was the in-home maid who mm-hmm. was abusing Leonie, and that was why she was having so much trauma, and no one knew.
Nobody knew why.
Nobody knew why she was struggling to this degree, and why she was violent, and why she would completely shut out Zelie mm-hmm. and wanted nothing to do with her. So, you know, there's, oh my gosh, the layers of struggles. But the thing is that, okay, what did Zelie do? And this isn't a whole podcast on Zelie, but I think it's really good to understand her in this way of, like, you know, what she writes about frequently, yes, she was, I don't know who wouldn't be consumed with, like, in a way, like, with a child who's really struggling. Mm-hmm. But her prayer was always, oh, like, Lord, I give her to you. Mm-hmm. I give her to you. I give her to you.
Yeah.
And what I think is particularly amazing is that, you know, Leonie went on to go through a lot of healing herself mm-hmm. and eventually joined the Visitation Nuns, who are known for their gentleness. And she's the next Martin child whose cause for canonization is open after Therese. And it, like, so here's the thing is, like, our Father is good and he's faithful. So in spite of the fact that Zelie was never healed of massive anxiety, and mm-hmm. it was likely an emotional relief to her family when she died, mm-hmm. nonetheless, like, God is sovereign over all of it. Mm-hmm. And so he's bigger. So we don't have to put this, I don't know. I just think sometimes there's this perfectionist pressure that we put on ourselves, like, oh man, if I don't resolve my stuff, like, I'm going to cause irreparable damage mm-hmm. to XYZ.
Sure. Could I just read a couple passages from the book?
Oh yeah.
Let me read a couple paragraphs here that sum up, I think, what you're saying really, really well. Not only was Zelie unaware of the negative impact that her emotional state was having on Therese, but it was also beyond her control. Mm-hmm. Zelie did not choose her mother, referring to Zelie's own mother, who was very severe with her and made her childhood and youth as dismal as a winding sheet, which is a shroud. And the author goes on to say, not only did she not have any control over the death of her four children, Leonie's troubled personality, or her breast cancer, all of which contributed to her anxious state, Zelie could not protect Therese from her anxiety. Is there any wonder why Zelie's death, while being a great loss for Therese, was not also a source of relief? Mm-hmm. But he goes on to say that Zelie was a loving mother and a holy woman. The church has this at the time of this writing, the church has declared her venerable, the first step in the process of becoming canonized saint. But even the saints are not exempt from the woundedness of the mm-hmm. human condition. Zelie, like every parent, could not protect her child from herself.
Yes.
And I think, you know, it's important to understand that as we look at the history of these women, there really is, there are genuine mental health struggles that are there, and you can't deny them without denying history. And yet it's also crucial to understand that these women, with all of their brokenness and all of their mental health struggles, nonetheless managed to become holy in the midst of these struggles, not by denying them and not by running from them, but being who they were. And I think you speak very well to that. We sometimes think that we have to be perfectly healed in order to become holy.
Right.
And that type of all or nothing thinking, I think really, especially in women, introduces a lot of perfectionism that ends up actually being quite destructive. Yeah. In addition to just being plain wrong. This idea that I have to be this, it's almost like I have to be a saint before I can become a saint.
It doesn't make
sense, does it?
No. And I think it can engender this frustration or lack of forgiveness with our past. And we're constantly looking at our past and thinking, you know, oh man, why did this happen to me? Or I can't believe I did that. Or I think now that has led to this issue in my life. But it's like, yes, that is, it just, it's the way in which that bent is portrayed. We all know that we have, everybody goes through to varying degrees, really difficult periods of time, but it's what happens in the midst of seeing like, yes, I have this woundedness now. It's relieving though, I will say, when I admit that like, this doesn't dominate me and I can give it over to God and move along. So
many years ago in a presidential debate, Ronald Reagan looked at Jimmy Carter and said, oh, there you go again. You know, and I think there's a certain peace that comes when someone can, in a sense, recognize, you know, rather than saying, oh my God, isn't this awful? And this is terrible. And go on and on and on, and then say, but then why do I even struggle with this? And it's so terrible and stuff. When you can sort of detach from that and just kind of laugh at yourself and say, oh, there I go again. there's a real peace that comes from that. And then once you get, which is in a way, a form of mindfulness, you know, to just be able to say, oh yeah, like I suffer from anxiety. This is what's happening right now. And Jesus, I turn that over to you.
Yeah.
And Jesus, where is the grace here? You know, I am driving along in a car listening to music, and I've got two kids in the back, and all of a sudden this anxiety attack spikes. I have no idea why.
Yeah.
You know, and then to be able to just calm yourself down and say, I don't understand why this anxiety is coming right now. But to be able to get to the place where you say, I don't need to understand it. I just know that it's happening right now. And somehow, Jesus, this is yours.
Yeah.
You know, and to be able to just kind of surrender that over and really pray that open-ended prayer that says, Jesus, show me where the grace is now. Not to wish the anxiety wasn't happening, not to shove it out of your consciousness and pretend it's not there, you know. Or to rebel against it and wish it wasn't so and get mad at God that it's not the way you want. But to be able to just sort of say, Jesus, show me the grace here.
Yeah.
And to be able to approach God with those open-ended prayers and invite grace into that anxiety. And to not necessarily feel like you need to even see where that grace is going, but just that radical openness to grace, even in the midst of your anxiety and your suffering, that I think in some ways is the little way.
Yeah.
That's Therese, you know, and the book talks about, you know, Therese's ability or her difficulty in managing her own emotions.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so like the woman being in the car, you know, driving along and the anxiety, you know, that was Therese's existence. She had a constant battle to manage her emotions, but that battle in managing her emotions is the place that she invited the Holy Spirit into.
Right.
And turned that into a graced experience. And I think if you're someone who denies your inability to manage your own emotions, in a sense, like you're not living in reality.
Right.
Because that's who you are. You're struggling with anxiety. You're struggling with the inability to manage the emotions. And so, you know, you've got to be that person struggling in that moment and invite grace into that moment and not pretend that that moment isn't happening. Because if you pretend it's not happening, then you get into repression, which is no good.
Right.
Or you can just rebel and get angry that that is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can say, in the words of a knickknack I saw in a catalog one time, bless this mess.
I'm sure that that is a sign on the wall of somebody who's listening to this right now. this reminds me, I just finished this book called, it's from Word on Fire, called St. Catherine of Siena, Mystic of Fire, Preacher of Freedom. And he talks about Carl Jung's, it has some Jung psychology in it, but it is an amazing book on St. Catherine of Siena. And probably my favorite part, and it's a book I'll read again and again, so I'm sure there'll be other parts that speak to me, but the part that spoke to me this time especially was when she talks about the circle of self-knowledge. And she was like, you have to know yourself.
Right.
And she said, imagine, you know, you're a tree that grows within this circle, and it remains within this circle. And the circle includes, like, God is, you know, all powerful. He's never ending. You're always within his providence. But the soil that you're growing within is the humility of understanding who you are. And when you invite God into that, when you see that, okay, I struggle with my emotions. Okay, I struggle with anxiety. And these things are really here. Like you know, I'm quick tempered. I'm X, Y, Z, or whatever that might be. And just stopping and saying, like, I'm here, Lord. I see fully at this moment what you've allowed me to see about myself. And I'm not going to hate this. I'm not going to hate myself. But instead, I invite you in. And she talks about how it's there that we can actually understand how compassionate our Father is to us. But we have to be able to see ourselves and not close in either in self-hatred or close in out of just self-denial, but to be there and then to truly believe who God is a compassionate Father.
Sure.
And it's in that place that the deeper we know ourselves and who we are, the more deeply we know who the Father is, because we will experience to an even greater and greater degree how compassionate he is.
The whole logic of the incarnation, in a sense, is that Jesus walked into a mess. When you think about it, it's at the core of our Christian faith, you know, and you go back to the Bible and to the book of Romans, as it says, you know, in that marvelous passage about how while we were still in sin, Jesus came to us. And it wasn't the idea that, okay, world, fix yourself. And then I'll show up. The whole logic of the Christian faith is that Jesus shows up in the mess. He goes into a broken world. He doesn't go into a world that, in a sense, is, you know, he doesn't walk into a house that somebody has cleaned for him when he enters into the human world. He enters into a mess because he knew that the world was a mess and that we needed grace. And I think we spend a lot of our time as Christians denying the mess, denying the humanity, as if Jesus can't handle this. You know? As if Jesus hasn't walked into every mess that has existed since the beginning of human history. You know, the whole logic of the incarnation is that Jesus enters into the world of reality. He enters into the mess. And I think that's one of the lessons of Thérèse of Lisieux. Like, as you understand yourself as a spiritual being, there's a powerful lesson Thérèse gives us about kind of living in reality and acknowledging the reality of who you are. And inviting God's grace into that reality and trusting that he wants to be in that reality. And I think it goes all the way back to the incarnation. And it goes deep into people's image of God and this idea that I have this set of values, I'm not living up to them, I need to sort of get to this perfectionistic image and then I'm holy.
Right.
That's half true.
Right.
We all have the capacity to grow in virtue. That's right. In fact, that's maybe the lesson of Thérèse of Lisieux as well. But the idea that we have to live in reality and be who we are and not disavow who we are or pretend to be somebody else,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this is Christianity.
Right.
You know, bless this mess is actually really good theology.
Well,
it's the incarnation.
What was it that, did we read this already? Or was it when we were talking before we started recording? For me, it's page 14. I think it was 13 for you. Mm-hmm. Where it says, however, Thérèse does not apologize for her fears.
Right.
She does not berate herself for feeling like a child. Rather, her fears and insecurities are the context mm-hmm. within which she places her trust in God.
Right. And I think it's important to understand that given some of Therese's attachment trauma, there was no way she was not going to feel like a child.
Right.
Okay. So given Therese's psychological history, there was no way she was not going to be that way.
Right.
Which I think is an absolutely crucial piece to understand.
Right.
There were, in other words, like given the difficulties that she experienced, there was no way she was going to be another way. Mm-hmm. And either God is going to work in the context of who she is or right. he's not.
Mm.
So God can only work in your case with the woman that you are.
Right.
Right. There's no use in maintaining an image.
Mm. Yep.
There's no use because it's not reality.
Right.
Any transformation that takes place in anybody's life has to come in the context of them acknowledging the reality of who they are. I see this as a psychotherapist all the time. But when you stop and think about it, in the world of grace, it isn't any different.
Mm.
Okay. So if I have this sin, if I have this mental health issue, either God's grace is going to come into that or it simply remains disavowed and hidden.
Right. It's the shameful part of me.
That's right. That
it makes me think, you know, the meditation that I read this morning was on her yesterday. I think it was, you know, either it was a comparison between the thief that died, you know, on one side of Jesus versus the one who died on the other. The other one, the one who goes to paradise,
mm-hmm.
you know, the first canonized saint of the church is dying there.
Saint Dismas.
Thief, right. And that's the grace of God is the gift. Today you will be immediately mm-hmm. with me in paradise.
Yeah.
It's not something that we earn out of some kind of white knuckled grab right. on our concept of perfection.
Right.
Instead, it is whether or not we are willing to receive a gift mm-hmm. that we don't deserve because of our actions
yeah.
and choices, whether or not we are willing to be loved as a child who did not bring themselves into existence,
right.
but who was wanted and wanted knowing what we would go through, wanted mm-hmm. knowing the choices we would make.
Yeah.
And that, yeah.
I love the way you said that because you think of St. Dismas on the cross and it's just so crystal clear that he's like, I deserve to be here for my sin. I'm a thief
yeah.
and I deserve to be here for my sins. You know, and turns to the other man and says, you know, but Jesus doesn't deserve to be here. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. Mm-hmm. And Jesus says, it's almost like, you know, the current phrase, the mic drop, this day you will be with me in paradise.
Yeah.
He admits who he is and he accepts the gift of grace.
Mm-hmm.
Because at this point, Dismas doesn't have any chance anymore
right.
to try to get his act together.
Right.
He's done. He right. can't get his act together. He doesn't. He no longer has the possibility of living up to a set of values. He's about to die in crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it beautiful to see how you look at the life of Dismas, and it was a tragic, sinful life that ended in failure.
Right.
It was a tragic human life. And yet, it's in that life that Jesus declares, this day you will be with me in paradise. Right. And the only difference between him and the guy that was crucified on the other side of Jesus is that Dismas accepted a gift.
Yes.
He accepted the gift of God's grace in his sinful, broken, wasted humanity. And Jesus says, you will be with me in paradise.
Yeah.
That's the gospel.
Yeah. Amen. I think that's a good place for us to stop our first one, huh?
Okay.
All right. Awesome.